shoulder and stands back. The terror in me reaches a fever pitch. Everything around me seems to fade away as Jax pulls her gun from her holster and pulls it back with a click. This should be the part when I scream something out, where one word from me makes everyone stop and look in my direction. But instead, I can't utter a sound. Jax points the gun straight down at Tremaine's forehead. She fires a single shot. Tremaine's body jerks. He crumples to the floor. My hands clamp over my mouth to keep me from letting out a cry. The shot rings in my ears. The kill I'd once seen Jax make now comes back to me in a wave, and I double over, hunching against the wall as I try to brace myself against the onslaught of the memory. We believe that there are too many people in the world who go unpunished for committing terrible crimes. Those were Taylor's words that had ultimately persuaded me to join the Blackcoats. She had told me they fought for causes they believed in. Their actions were justified because they all feared what Hideo was capable of. But in a single moment, every positive thing I ever thought about the Blackcoats, every word they'd plied me with, vanishes. Tremaine was alive just a second ago, and now he's dead. And it's because of me. Breathe. Breathe. But I can't think straight. I can't function in this moment except to crouch like some kind of coward, trembling uncontrollably against the wall. The glass room in front of me blurs and straightens. I think I see Taylor stepping back as two guards drag the body away. Another lingers behind to clean up the floor. Zero leans toward Jax to speak in a low voice, while Taylor tucks something into the hands of the other guards. No one looks concerned. It suddenly occurs to me that the guards here were paid to wait around and bring Tremaine's body outside, so that they could drive it off somewhere. They were prepared to execute him. My panic is cutting my breath short. I feel faint. The edges of my view are darkening, fading out, and I fight against it, the logical part of my mind telling me that if I collapse now, here, they'll find me. And if they know I've seen all this, they won't hesitate to do the exact same thing to me that they just did to Tremaine. Jax looks bored, exasperated with that person who took up her time. She hadn't even looked back at Tremaine's body, which she'd left on the floor. How many has she killed this way? The Blackcoats are murderers. Tremaine had warned me to stay away from them from the start. He'd only been here because he was looking out for me, and I'd gone ahead anyway. Now he's dead. What if the Blackcoats are already out looking for me, having learned the connection between Tremaine and my work? What have I done? I can't do this. I can't stay here. I close my eyes and count, forcing myself to focus on the train of numbers in my head until they're all I see. Hideo needs to know this. But what do I tell him? I don't even understand everything I just saw. What is that robot that Zero had been commanding? And if he's not here in person, where is he? Get up, Emmy. I whisper the words over and over, until finally I unfreeze myself. I push my body off from the wall, rise from my crouch, and stumble back the way I came. Feverishly, I pull up my menus and set my maps for the hotel. I make my way far enough so that I've left the horrible room behind me and have re-entered the soaring main lobby of the complex. I swing my new board down toward the floor, ready to hop on it, but my hands are shaking so badly that I drop it with a clatter. I lunge in vain to catch it. A click makes me whirl around. Jax is standing there, her pale skin stark against the black walls, her gun pointed directly at my head. Her gray eyes pierce through me. "You're not supposed to be here," she says. Chapter 17. I don't dare answer. I just stay where I am and lift my hands over my head. She waves her gun once at me. Up. I do as she says. There are a few flecks of blood on her glove. Tremaine's blood. And my eyes lock on to the sight. She's going to kill me for being here, and there's nowhere for me to hide. I'm going to die on the floor of this building, just like Tremaine did. Why the hell did you come here? She snaps at me in a whisper. I was looking for Zero, I say, not even believing my own bad excuse. My words come out haltingly, and I can hear the tremor in them. I'm meeting Hideo tomorrow night. Jax observes me carefully. She knows I'm lying. But instead, she says, You saw, didn't you? I shake my head vigorously. I heard. Usually, I can lie better than this. But right now, the panic in my eyes gives me away. It was too dark. All I got were voices down the hall. Jax sighs. She almost looks like she feels sorry for me, and I wonder if she recognizes the same look on my face from when she'd killed my assassin. It's impressive that I didn't catch you on your way into the building, but here we are now. The echo of Tremaine's killing shot still rings in my head, bursting over and over again, and my hands yearn to reach up and cover my ears. Jax tightens her grip on her gun. This is it. My limbs are frozen in place. Walk. What? My feet feel rooted to the floor. Jax seizes my arm and shoves me once. Her nails dig hard into my skin. If they know you're here, you're dead, she growls in my ear, shoving me forward. Go. Her words register through my chaotic mind, and I manage to shoot her a confused glance as she starts pulling me along the shadowed wall of the main lobby. Where are you taking me? I whisper. Jax leads me down another dark hall on the opposite end of the lobby. Less talking, more walking, she replies. Whatever shred of silence I'd managed to hold on to now breaks, and my words come spilling out. And then what? Will you take me out too? A shot to the head, just like Tremaine? Where are you taking his body? She turns those pale gray eyes on me again. So, you did see. I shake my head repeatedly, trying in vain to get Tremaine's crumpled body out of my mind. What are you all doing here? I say over and over again. What is that robot Zero was controlling? Where is he? Jax doesn't answer me. We reach the end of the hall and a small side entrance that opens into the back of the building where a few cars are parked. Here, Jax suddenly shoves me up against the wall and presses a gloved hand over my mouth. She looks as cold as ever, but there's tension in her eyes now and she keeps glancing around to make sure we're alone. In a minute, I'm going to tell you to go outside and get in the car farthest to your left. It'll take you back to the hotel. The guards out front are busy with Tremaine's body. Keep your head down, and don't try to come back here. Do you understand me? I struggle out of her grip. But you... She shoves me again hard, and puts her gun right against my head. Ice-cold metal. I hear it click at my temple. But I hit your stupid friend Tremaine with a grazing shot to his head. I'll direct his car to a hospital. Don't you dare visit him tonight, unless you want Taylor to find out that you somehow knew he'd be there the instant he arrived. Wait until tomorrow morning. None of this makes sense at all. What? Taylor? My whisper turns hoarse. You shot Tremaine. Zero's the head of... Jax lets out a quiet, surprised laugh and lowers her gun. You think Taylor works for Zero, don't you? A note of hesitation enters my voice. She tried to warn me. Zero. Jax's smile is cold. Zero doesn't run things. Taylor does. We follow her command. Taylor leads the black coats. I blink. That can't be right. She's far too quiet and uncertain for that. Her soft voice, her delicate shoulders, and thoughtful look. Hadn't she deferred to Zero the first time I met them? Hadn't she let him talk? Let him talk. Like he worked for her. But, I try to say, Taylor doesn't seem like... My voice trails off at Jax's expression. She is dead serious, and in her eyes, I see an emotion I've never seen before on her face. Real fear. Fear of Taylor. Jax, the girl who can eat a snack and then shoot someone in the head, who doesn't bat an eye at the sight of blood, is terrified of Taylor. Now I'm truly frightened. Jax tears her gaze away and leans close. Once you get back to the hotel, she murmurs against my ear, I'm going to send you an invite to the Dark World. You're going to meet me in there, and then I can tell you more. Why should I believe you? I spit each word out, relying on my anger to keep my tears at bay. Because you're still alive, she replies, and not bleeding out on the floor. There are so many things I want to say back to her. That I saw her standing on the balcony with Zero, that I don't know why she's sparing me right now or why she's going behind Taylor's back on Tremaine. But this is no time to press her. All I can do is follow her instructions, even though nothing's stopping her from hunting down my car the instant I get inside it. Maybe this is her strategy for killing me tonight, too. She'll talk me into getting into the car and then run it right off the road. Call it an accident. Faint footsteps come from the other side of the main lobby. Jax turns her head sharply in their direction, then looks back at me. You get one warning from me. If you ever come back here again, I'll put a bullet in you before I can even think it through. Now shut up and go. My numb legs somehow carry me to the car. I sit in silent shock as it starts up, then takes me back to the hotel. I want to scream at the car to bring me to Tremaine instead. I want to figure out wherever he's been taken to. Tell him I'm sorry and beg him to forgive me. He's lying in a hospital somewhere, fighting for his life because of me. If he dies, my hands will be dipped in his blood. Jax's last words to me ring in my head. Part of me expects my car windows to shatter from gunfire, that she's set me up and is just waiting for me to turn my back. But everything outside my window looks exactly as I'd left it. The cosplay parade is still in full swing. The streets still neon-colored. Some are cheering the final two top player announcements as excitement for the closing ceremony builds to a fever pitch. Oliver Anderson of Australia, Cloud Knights. Carla Castillo of Costa Rica, Storm Chasers. Others whistle as a group of their friends goes by and spot on Phoenix Riders gear from one of our championship games. For them, no time has passed at all. They haven't just witnessed someone they know get shot, smelled the blood on the ground. They don't feel like they'd just seen a slice of truth that changes everything about what they're doing. As far as they're concerned, the world is still intact. They're not responsible for putting their friend in fatal danger. When I arrive, the car door opens for me and I step out, as if everything were fine. The elevator dings like it's supposed to. The bed in my hotel is still there, freshly made, and a plate of fruit, lychee starfruit pears, sits on my writing desk, wrapped in a clean film of plastic wrap. I stand for a moment in the shadows of my curtains, watching the colors and the outfits go by on the street below. Everyone is laughing and waving, blissfully unaware of the dark world around them. I wash my hands in the sink. A few flecks of blood dot my clothes, and for an instant, I think they're Tremaine's, until I see the gash in my sleeve. I must have cut myself in my rush. I strip off my clothes, step into the shower, and let the water scald me until my skin turns pink. Then I wrap myself in a robe and sit down on the bed, the sounds of festivities still ringing from the street. I notice the earlier messages I'd tried to send to Tremaine, still unread and unanswered. What tears couldn't come earlier now emerge in a rush. I cry, deep choking sobs that echo in my chest, barely able to catch my breath before I let it out again. My hands clench at the bedsheets. Has it only been hours since I stood beside Hideo and told him about his brother? Has it been only a heartbeat since I watched Tremaine crumple to the floor? I can still picture his silhouette against the rain, his faraway look, and that careless shrug. Right now, Tremaine's out there in some hospital, lying on a gurney while they probably rush him into the emergency room. He'd gotten too close, and he'd taken the hit that should have been mine. Now I'm alone, lost in this battle between Hideo's algorithm and the Black Coat's secrets. How will Roshan react when he finds out what has happened? Are the other Phoenix Riders going to be in danger too if I keep them involved? Every locked door has a key. But maybe that's not true at all. What key is there now? I no longer know which way to turn. I don't know which way is right or even which way is out. The image of Tremaine on a gurney is abruptly replaced by old memories of hospital corridors, that familiar, awful smell of disinfectant seared permanently into my memories. For a moment, I'm 11 years old again, walking through the door of my father's hospital room with an arm full of peonies and a dinner tray. I'd put the flowers in a vase and sat cross-legged on the end of his bed as we ate our hospital food together. Dad's once thick, bright blue hair was patchy and gray, falling out daily in chunks. His hospital gown crinkled against his gaunt shoulders in a weird way. He would spear each piece of soggy broccoli individually and pop it into his mouth, cut each piece of meatloaf carefully with his fork. But he avoided the little square of chocolate cake. "Sugar might as well be poison," he'd told me when I asked him why he left it on his plate. And all I could think about at the time was the Space Shuttle Challenger, which I'd just learned about in school that morning. The government likes the official story to be that the shuttle's explosion killed the entire crew instantly. But the truth is that the cabin was intact after the Challenger's rocket blew. They went sailing 3 more miles into the sky and then plummeted for 2.5 minutes until they hit the Atlantic Ocean at full speed, fully conscious and aware the whole time. And in spite of staring directly into the face of death, they'd still pulled on their oxygen masks, had their seatbelts clipped in. We fight for survival with everything we've got. As if the oxygen mask and the seatbelt and avoidance of a square of chocolate cake might be the thing that saves us. That's the difference between the real and the virtual. Reality is where you can lose the ones you love. Reality is the place where you can feel the cracks in your heart. When the world is murky, guide yourself with your own steady light. My father's old words are a low, steady undercurrent in my mind. I can see him smile wearily at me over our dinner trays, his fingers first tapping his temple, then his chest over his heart. "Hold steady, Emmy. Keep going." I sit in the darkness until my tears have dried and my breathing has turned even again. It's 2 o'clock in the morning now. The parade outside is finally quieted, and people start heading home. I sit until I can think straight again. Tremaine had chosen this path. If I back out now, his sacrifices would have been for nothing. I sit until a new message blinks in my view. It's from an anonymous account, asking me to link with this person in the dark world. It's Jax. Jax, who's right in the middle of this murky nightmare, with nothing for me to trust about her except the fact that I should be dead by her hand right now. Are you ready? She asks. I look up at the hovering invitation through my blur of tears. Why are you doing this? Who do you think gave Jesse info in the first place? The anonymous contact who'd shown Jesse the Institute badge. That had been Jax. She's been watching me after all. Has known I was working with Tremaine. Had noticed Jesse asking around in the dark world about Sasuke's symbol. We don't have all night, Emika. I stare at the prompt, steadying myself. Then I reach up and accept it. Chapter 18. 2 days until the Warcross closing ceremony. The room around me vanishes into darkness. A moment later, I find myself standing in the middle of a nondescript black street, illuminated by highlights of blue and red neon. A small but steady trickle of encrypted passersby bustle back and forth behind me. Next to me stands an anonymous girl with a face I don't recognize. I don't need to, though. When she rests her hand unconsciously on her belt and drums rhythmically against it, itching for a gun handle, I know right away that it's Jax. She doesn't introduce herself. She just turns her face toward the closest corner and nods for me to follow her. I do without saying a word. As we walk, a giant stop sign, painted yellow instead of red, appears at the intersection of two streets. And when Jax leads us to the other side of the road, another stop sign appears. They keep popping up until the signs line both sides of the street, and the closer we walk, the more appear. The optical illusion is an eerie one, and the way it shifts makes me dizzy. Close your eyes, Jax says when she sees my expression. After Hideo's algorithm triggered, the keepers of this place put this in as a deterrent to any past visitors who might now be compelled to rat it out. If you keep looking at it, it'll make you violently ill. Unless you know the new password. So close your eyes, then follow my instructions. Again, I do as she says. In the darkness, Jax calls out the number of steps for me to take, and when to turn. I fight the constant sensation that I might trip over something, and force myself to keep moving. Finally, we stop. You're good now, Jax says. I open my eyes. Ever heard of this place? She asks, nodding at the block before us. All I can do is shake my head and stare. Towering in front of us is an enormous, impossible building that looks like a giant glass dome reaching higher than the Empire State Building, taking up the entire block. Thin black bridges extend from the dome like toothpicks in a bubble, connecting it with giant, floating glass circles suspended in the air. The entire structure looks like a grand model of the sun and planets. Black metal lattices crisscross the glass as if needed to hold it all up, and around its base are a series of spotlights shining against it, casting beams of crimson color into the air and onto the ground. Fountains as tall as waterfalls line the perimeter of the dome in a lavish display, a dozen times grander than any physical fountain could possibly be. It's the Dark World's Fair, Jax continues, motioning me forward with her toward the huge arched entrance, where a stream of people are entering and leaving the place. It's like the World's Fairs in real life, except here, the exhibitions for sale are a bit more illegal. I crane my neck in awe as we walk underneath the towering dome. The first time I'd ever heard of World's Fairs was in school, and I can still remember staring down at my laptop at an article about them. The Eiffel Tower was originally built for the Paris World's Fair in 1889. So was the original Ferris wheel, invented for the Chicago World's Fair back in 1893. Dad was a fan of researching these grand exhibitions because he found them incredibly romantic, each one a creator's dreamscape. I remember sitting up at night, listening to him describe one famous World's Fair after another. I wonder what he'd say if he could have seen this place. Now we step through the entrance with other avatars and emerge inside a space that takes my breath away. Underneath the soaring glass ceiling is a vast area full of displays, each one roped off and surrounded by clusters of admirers and potential buyers. Strings of lights hang in elegant arcs from the glass ceiling, adding to how surreal the place looks. Tiny mechanical birds flit by, as if in an aviary. When I look closely, I notice them carrying blank notes strapped to their wiry legs. Those birds are encrypted packets for secure messaging between the visitors here. Jax nods at a couple of the exhibitions we pass. These are funded by secret patrons, developed illegally at the Innovation Institute, she says in a quiet voice. By Taylor. One of these exhibits is a cloud of data, a million tiny specks that swarm and separate from each other, then swarm close again. Another is a display of weapons with glowing blue ovals running along their edges, sensors for your specific fingerprints. A third is a demonstration of invisibility done through the Neuralink. Instead of downloading a randomly generated face over your own as a disguise, it maps your surroundings and combines them into a lattice that covers your body, making you vanish from view. I look at her. And Taylor is selling these technologies? She nods. Quite a few of them, for the right price. I shake my head and stop right underneath a grand rotating display of armored suits. How is Taylor developing all these illegal devices from a proper science institute? And how are the black coats connected? What do you know about Taylor? Not much, just what she's told me. She said her father was killed because of his illicit activities. Jax's lips tighten. Dana Taylor grew up during a rough time, around when the Soviet Union collapsed. Her father laundered money for a living. As a child, Taylor saw more than her share of death. She ended up studying neuroscience because she was always interested in how the mind works, the way it manufactures every aspect of our world. The mind can make you believe whatever it wants you to believe. It can bring dictators to power. It can crumble nations. You can do anything if you put your mind to it. You know the saying. Well, she truly takes that to heart. If the mind weren't dependent upon the rest of the body, it could operate forever. I nod absently at Jax's words. They echo what Taylor had said to me. When she got a job at the Innovation Institute as a junior researcher and moved to Japan, that became her obsession. Learning how to disconnect the mind from the body, separating its strength from its ultimate weakness. Her obsession. I think of what Taylor had told me. Is it because of her father's murder? Jax pauses for a moment. Everyone's afraid of death, but Taylor is absolutely terrified of it. The finality. Of seeing your father dead, gone forever without an explanation? The idea of her mind just shutting off one day, without warning. An uneasy feeling lurches in my stomach. In spite of myself, I can understand that fear. I can taste it in my mouth. And what about the black coats, I say. Taylor worked her way up the ladder at the Institute rapidly until she became its executive director. But there was some study she wanted to do that the Institute simply wouldn't approve. As you know, She grew up around illegal dealings. The idea of her not being able to do what she wanted was unacceptable. Hence, the Black Coats. She created the group as the shell for all the experiments she wanted to conduct that she didn't have permission for. I don't understand. Let's say, for example, that Taylor wanted to do something that she knew she couldn't get approved by the Institute. She would go ahead and conduct that experiment anyway, under the guise of something else, some innocuous study. And she would make sure every shred of paperwork and evidence of that experiment would get funneled toward the Black Coats instead. If she sells the results of that experiment to someone, a foreign government, some other foundation, it would be traced only to the Black Coats. I narrow my eyes as I start to understand. So the Black Coats, they're essentially a false business name, Jax finishes. An empty shell, underneath which all of Taylor's secret projects are kept. None of the data would ever lead back to her, I say in realization. Right. Let's say that news got out about some illegal weapon Taylor was developing at the Institute. Investigators would find the trails leading not to Taylor's name, but to some mystery group called the Black Coats. Taylor could claim she was an innocent bystander, her identity stolen and used by the Black Coats. The clients who bought the tech from her can also point their fingers at the Black Coats. So the news reports would all say something like, "Who are the Black Coats, mystery criminal ring in the business of illegal tech development?" The Black Coats get the blame and the reputation as some shadowy crew. What was all that about the Black Coats being a group of vigilantes who fight for causes they believe in, I say. Lies, Jax says with a shrug. We are not vigilantes, Amika. We're mercenaries. We do what we get paid for. But how does Hideo's algorithm fit into all this? Why does Taylor care about destroying it? Is someone paying her for that? At that, Jax gives me a dark look. Taylor doesn't want to destroy the algorithm. She wants to control it. To control it. The obvious truth of it hits me so hard that I can barely breathe. Of course she would. Why would someone like Taylor, obsessed with the power of the mind, want to cripple the Neuralink by ripping out such an intricate system like the algorithm? Why hadn't I guessed that she might have other plans for it? During our first encounter, Taylor had sat across from me and looked so sincere, so genuine about what she wanted to do. She knew how to turn my own history against me, baiting me with what I had done for Annie that had gotten me the red on my record. She manipulated me into agreeing with her that what the Black Coats were doing was noble. The conversation tears through my mind. How timid and quiet she had seemed. How perfectly she had played that moment. Jax watches me as these thoughts sink in. I know, she says, breaking the silence. I nod numbly back. Jax looks away from me and up at the bridges lining the main dome ceiling. The Black Coats use the Dark World's Fair as storage for their archives. Every experiment they've conducted, every mission they've run, everything they do is locked away here in a blockchain, one secured packet after another. A blockchain. An encrypted ledger of records nearly impossible to trace or change. Jax stops at the very edge of the dome's glass in an empty corner. This is what I wanted you to see. The story behind Sasuke. It's what you've been after, isn't it? My heart squeezes when I hear her words, and again I see the memory I'd glimpsed in Zero's mind. The image of Sasuke's small figure crouched in a room, the strange symbol on his sleeve. I bring up the image now for Jax. Her eyes immediately jump to Sasuke, and her face softens for a moment. What is your story? I find myself thinking. How did you cross paths with Sasuke? She finally touches my arm and motions me forward. As she does, she slides her other hand once against the glass. A panel shifts with her movement, like an invisible door in the dome, with stairs curling downward into darkness. Only Taylor and I have access to these archives. Jax suddenly hesitates, and in her silence, I understand that if word got out that Jax had shown this place to me, Taylor would kill her too. Just you and Taylor? I ask. Not Zero? You'll see why in a second. She gestures for me to follow her in. Careful you leave no traces behind. I watch as Jax steps in through the door, then glances around to see whether anyone else might be watching. But no one seems able to see us or the entrance that Jax opened up. It's as if we'd existed in an entirely different virtual dimension from the others here. I look back to see Jax's figure disappear into the shadows of the stairs. I take a deep breath and follow her in. The stairs vanish rapidly into pitch black, and even though I know I'm in a virtual world, I still instinctively put my hand out, searching for the wall beside me. Moving in the darkness here where nothing's real makes me feel like I'm not moving at all. The only hint I get that we're making progress are the sounds of Jax's footsteps, still moving steadily downward ahead of me. Gradually, the ground before us lightens, and when we reach the bottom of the stairs, everything is illuminated in a soft, dim blue glow. We step out into a vast chamber that takes my breath away. Welcome to the library, Jax tells me over her shoulder. It looks like all the books in the universe, shelved in an endless circular room framed by ladders that stretch in both directions. I imagine every book is a file that the Black Coats have stored. Archives upon archives of research, data on specific people, records of missions. This is their central directory. We stand on a platform, looking up and down into the endless space, and I have to close my eyes to fight off the vertigo. Jax motions me onto one of the ladders. We click right into place against it, so that it's impossible to fall, but I still feel a wave of dizziness. We store every iteration of a memory, and duplicates of every file. She opens a search directory, and in front of us, types in Sasuke Tanaka. The world around us blurs, and an instant later, we're on the ladder against a new section of the library where certain books are now glowing with a blue halo. Jax pulls them out with a wave of her hand. They form a ring around us, and when I stare at any one of them long enough, it starts to play the first few frames of the recording. There are records from the Black Coat's security cams, from Sasuke's memories, from white-coated technicians, and from what look like actual tests and trials. There are police reports, files about his disappearance, and data on his parents. There are also files about young Hideo. I remember the first time I sat in Hideo's office, studying Zero's hacks, wondering who my bounty was. I remember the way Hideo tilted his head up to the sky at the onsen. The endless versions of his constructed memory of how Sasuke had disappeared. These files will show me what really happened to Sasuke all those years ago. Jax looks at me, then gestures at the files. We can't stay in here forever, she reminds me. If you want to know something, find it now. I hesitate for only a second. Then I scroll through, sorting the files by date so that I can look at the oldest ones first. I find one dated 10 years ago, the year Sasuke disappeared, and tap it. It's a recording from a security cam, and it starts to play. Chapter 19. We're standing in a room with 24 young children, probably no older than 10, each one wearing a yellow band around their wrist. They're sitting at white desks arranged in neat rows, as if in some sort of classroom. The bare walls are decorated with cheerful drawings of rainbows and trees. Posters that say, "Read and learn something new today," and "Different is special." In fact, the only part that doesn't look like a classroom are the technicians in white coats at the front, watching the children. A long window runs along the room's back wall. A bunch of adults are clustered there, looking on with craned necks, their faces curious and worried. Some are wringing their hands or talking to each other in low voices. Their expressions tell me without a doubt that they're parents. I look at the timestamp of the recording. This was before Sasuke was kidnapped. My gaze returns to the kids. I study each of their faces until I find one that I recognize. I spot Sasuke sitting near the center of the room. Jax stands next to me, looking on at the scene too. She smiles a little at the sight of young Sasuke, then nods toward a girl at the front of the room, her brown hair in two low pigtails. "Is that you?" I ask. "I was 7," Jax replies, "just like everyone else in the room. It was a requirement of this particular study, conducted by the Institute, specifically by Taylor. This is where I first met Sasuke." I glance toward the parents at the window. "Are your parents over there?" She shakes her head. "No. Taylor adopted me." Now I look at her in surprise. "Taylor's your mother?" "I wouldn't call how she raised me motherly," Jax mutters. "But yes, she found me in the hospital wing of an orphanage. Later on, I learned she adopted me to put me in this study." Jax points out two of the adults at the far left side of the window. It takes me a moment to recognize them as Hideo and Sasuke's parents, the same elderly couple I'd once met. "They look completely different," I murmur. "Decades younger, as if it hadn't only been 10 years since their son went missing." The mother, Mina Tanaka, is sharply dressed in a suit and a white lab coat with the Institute's logo on its pocket, her face young and her hair glossy black. The father seems nothing like the frail, sickly man I'd seen at Hideo's home, but like a slightly older version of Hideo now, with his handsome features and tall stature. I glance back at Jax. "What kind of study is this? Why are you and Sasuke in it?" "Every child you see in here is dying," Jax replies. "Of a disease. Of an autoimmune disorder. Of something terminal that medicine has deemed incurable." "Dying?" Hideo had never mentioned that. My gaze returns to Sasuke, his large liquid eyes dark against a small, pale face. I'd assumed it was the lighting. Did you know? Did Sasuke's parents know?" I stammer. "What about Hideo?" "I have no idea if his parents ever told Hideo," Jax says. "If he's never mentioned it to you, it probably means his parents kept that from him. I certainly was too young to grasp how sick I was. I didn't know that the reason no one wanted me was because, well, who would want to adopt a dying child? Sasuke himself didn't even know. All he thought at the time was that he got sick much more easily than other kids." She shrugs. "You don't really question things when you're that small. You believe everything is normal." I think of Hideo calling out for Sasuke to slow down at the park, the way he'd scolded his little brother as he wrapped the blue scarf snugly around Sasuke's neck. And this study focused only on terminally ill children? "The study was a trial for an experimental drug that was supposed to be revolutionary," Jax says. "Something that could cure various childhood diseases by taking advantage of the child's young cells to turn their own bodies into collections of supercells. So, you can imagine that parents who are running out of options would jump to sign their children up for this radical study. What was there to lose?" I look back at the room, lingering on each of the parents' faces pressed against the glass. They seem hopeful, watching every move their children make. Mina Tanaka clutches her husband's hand tightly to her chest. Her eyes never leave Sasuke. A deep nausea settles into my stomach. The scene reminds me of the false hope every new drug gave me and my father. This is the one. This might save you. There's always more to lose, I whisper. We look on as a researcher adjusts the wristband on one child. Of course, the study was a cover, Jax continues. While the study's small team was working earnestly on a real drug, Taylor was also conducting her own research. The real study. So what was her actual experiment? The third requirement of this study was each child's mind. A minimum IQ of at least 160 was necessary for the trial. They had to show remarkable self-discipline. They needed to demonstrate unusually high drive and motivation. Their brains had to light up in a very specific way during a series of exams Taylor gave them. She looks at me. You know how smart Hideo Tanaka is? Sasuke was even more so. He tested effortlessly into every single academy he qualified for. The way Taylor found me at the orphanage in the first place was because she'd heard about my high IQ score. She found out about Sasuke's through Mina herself, since the two of them worked in the institute. We both passed her exams. I swallow hard. Hideo had told me this about Sasuke, that his little brother had sat for many tests measuring his intelligence. What was Taylor looking for? I ask. A candidate whose mind was strong enough to withstand an experiment to separate the mind from the body. Suddenly, I make a connection so horrible that it makes me dizzy. So that's why Taylor had wanted each child to have a terminal illness, I breathe. Jax's eyes are stone cold, bleak with truth. If they died during the study, it could easily be blamed on their original illness, covered up. Their parents had already signed consent forms. This way they wouldn't get suspicious and start asking questions. As we look on, the recording finishes, then automatically goes to the next. We watch at least a dozen of them. Some of the kids in the study change as the recordings continue. The number of parents standing at the window start to dwindle too. I don't want to ask Jax where they went, whether those were the children who couldn't make it all the way through. We shift to a recording with a room empty of kids, with the sun setting through the windows. Taylor is speaking Japanese with another researcher, in a voice low enough that translations start appearing in English at the bottom of my view. I blink. The researcher is Mina. This is the third time your son has tested top of his group, Taylor says. She's giving Mina the same sympathetic, encouraging look she's always given me. In fact, Sasuke tested at a margin so high, we had to rework our categories. Mina frowns and lowers her head in an apologetic bow. I don't like how it's making him act at home. He has so many nightmares and can't seem to concentrate on anything. His doctor tells me his blood counts haven't improved enough. And he's lost more weight. Don't do this, Tanaka-san, Taylor says gently. We might be so close to a breakthrough. Mina hesitates as she looks into her colleague's eyes. I don't know what she sees there, but she manages a smile. I'm so sorry, Director, she finally says, and in her words is a deep exhaustion. I would still like to withdraw Sasuke from the trial. Then Taylor gives her a sorrowful, pitying look, the same one that had made me want to trust her. This might be your only chance to save your son. The guilt in Mina's eyes twists like a knife in my chest. She shakes her head again. We want him resting at home, where he can be happy, at least for a little while. Taylor says nothing to that. Instead, the two women just bow to each other. Taylor stares at the door long after Mina leaves through it. The next recording skips ahead, but this one starts with Taylor seated in what looks like her office, across from another researcher. You told me you had this well organized, Taylor says to him in a soft voice. The man bows his head in apology.
Mrs. Tanaka has already filed paperwork with the Institute. She doesn't want to keep her son in the program. You know she has a good relationship with the CEO. We have to let them go.
Does Mina suspect what we're doing? The researcher shakes his head.
No,
he replies. Taylor sighs, as if all of this genuinely pains her. She flips through a stack of papers on her desk.
Very well. Do we have any other participants in the program who might work? Your girl, Jackson Taylor.
The researcher slides another stack of papers toward her. Taylor studies them in silence. Her numbers are good, she replies, pushing up her glasses. But her exam reactions are far less ideal. She's too unpredictable to be a reliable candidate. Taylor's indifferent tone takes me aback. I glance at Jax to see what she might be thinking, but she only drums her fingers idly against her belt. Taylor closes her eyes, her brow furrowed in frustration. Show me Sasuke's files again. The researcher does as she says, handing over a stack of papers and pointing out several lines on the top page. The two sit quietly for a moment, flipping the pages, occasionally nodding.
Far more consistent.
Taylor's voice is clipped and efficient in a way that sends a chill down my spine. She closes the folder and begins to rub her temples anxiously.
It's too significant a difference. He would have been perfect. And now he'll just die at home, withering away to nothing in a couple of years. What a shame. What a waste. You won't be able to continue on with him, the researcher says. Then his voice lowers. At least not with his parents as willing participants.
Taylor pauses to look sharply up at him.
What are you suggesting? I'm just stating the facts.
But I can hear an unspoken suggestion in his words. She puts her hands down and studies his face. She doesn't speak for a long moment.
We're not in the business of kidnapping children, she says. You want to save his life? How is that any worse than what will already happen to him? It's like you said, he'll be dead soon.
Taylor sits with her fingers laced together, lost in thought. I wonder if she's thinking about the murder of her father, if she's dwelling on her loss, her fear of death. Whatever's going through her mind, it leaves a calm resolve on her face. Something righteous.
Those poor children, she finally whispers, almost to herself. What a shame.
I can see it in her eyes. She thinks what she's doing is noble. The realization makes me shrink back in horror. It reminds me of the determination on Hideo's face when he first told me about the algorithm. The image lingers in my mind as I consider both of them, willing to do terrible things to save the world.
If this experiment succeeds, the researcher goes on, you are going to have on your hands one of the most lucrative technologies in the world. The amount someone would pay for it would be astronomical. And think of all the lives you'd save.
He leans closer.
We are never going to find another patient better matched for this trial. I can promise you that.
Taylor rests her chin against one hand as she stares out into space. The light in the room has shifted before she speaks again. Make it quick. Make it discreet.
Of course. I'll start putting together a plan.
Good, Taylor takes a deep breath and straightens in her chair. Then I recommend we move forward with Sasuke Tanaka for our Project Zero. Chapter 20. Project Zero. My heart seizes. Hideo had thought that this nickname was just a hacker name. His marker. And it was. But what it really referred to was what Taylor called him. Project Zero. Study Zero. Their first experiment. Taylor lets out a deep sigh before closing the folder in her hand and sliding the papers back toward the researcher. Sasuke's time is limited. We can't afford to wait around. Before I can fully process what I'd just witnessed, the scene shifts to a small boy crouched in one corner of a room. Immediately, I recognize this as the same room I'd seen Sasuke in during our duel. So Taylor had taken him. She was the one responsible for that day in the park when a young Hideo called for his brother and never heard him answer. She unknowingly triggered the start of the Neuralink itself, the result of Hideo's overwhelming grief. The reason Tremaine's lying unconscious in a hospital bed. She's the reason why I'm even here, ensnared in this madness. The scene now seems like dawn, with the barest hint of light from the windows. But Sasuke's bed looks untouched, like he's been sitting in the same spot all night. Instead, he stays in the corner with his knees tucked up to his chin, still wearing that white, long-sleeved sweater with a symbol embroidered on one sleeve. His fingers worry endlessly at the blue scarf around his neck. The same scarf that Hideo had wrapped around him on their last day together. The door finally opens, casting a slanted rectangle of golden light onto the crouched boy. Instead of scrambling to his feet, he just shrinks farther against the wall and tightens his grip on the scarf. In the entryway stands a tall woman I recognize as Taylor. "How do you feel today, Sasuke?" she says in a gentle voice.
"Dr. Taylor, you said if I stayed quiet, you would let me go home today."
Sasuke replies in English, and his young voice sounds so innocent it pierces my chest. This was when he was still fully himself. Taylor sighs softly and leans against the door. Her kind face seems so sincere that if I didn't know better, I'd genuinely believe that she loved him as a mother would.
"And I meant that, sweetie, with my whole heart. You've been so good. We just have a little bit more to learn about you, and then we'll take you home. Can you do that for me?"
Sasuke tilts his head at the woman. "Then I want to call my mom first," he says, "to tell her that I'll be coming home today."
He's only 7, but he's already trying to negotiate. In this moment, I'm fiercely proud of him for not falling for Taylor's trusting voice as easily as I had. Taylor must have had the same thought as me, because Sasuke's words bring a smile to her face.
"You're such a smart boy," she says, a note of admiration in her tone.
She walks over to him and crouches down to lean on her knees.
"But today, we just need to do a quick scan of your brain. If you talk to your mother on the phone, it might upset you, and your mind won't be as calm as we need it to be. But I promise, it's so easy. You'll blink and it'll be done. Then you'll be on your way. Doesn't that sound nice, Sasuke-kun?"
Sasuke ignores her attempt at an affectionate honorific.
"No."
Taylor smiles again at his reply. But this time, she just looks on as a researcher steps in. Sasuke starts shaking his head as the man reaches him and tugs on his arm.
"I'm not going,"
he says, his voice turning more urgent.
"Now, Sasuke-kun," Taylor says, "if you don't, you'll force me to take away your scarf."
She reaches out and taps the scarf's fabric once, teasingly.
And I know that would make you very sad.
At that, Sasuke freezes.